They are one of the largest recipients of NIH funding. Their scientists played a substantial role in developing more than half the cancer drugs approved by the FDA in the last 5 years. Dana-Farber Cancer Institute has been making one advanced cancer discovery after another for over 75 years. At Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, what we do here changes lives everywhere. Find out more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Ben Bernanke wants a second term running the Fed, which is why he was on Capitol Hill today. President Obama probably wants a second term of his own as well, which is why at the White House today the word economy was spelled J-O-B-S. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing and online surveys. ConstantContact.com. And by Bank of America, which has begun a 10-year, $1.5 trillion investment in low to moderate income communities.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, the 3rd of December. Good to have you here. Washington, D.C. was a-poppin' today. There were two big events happening at opposite ends of Pennsylvania Avenue. Up on Capitol Hill, Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke got a rough-ish going over from the Senate Banking Committee. They are considering him for a second term running the U.S. economy, a job he will likely, in the end, finally get. Down at the White House, meanwhile, President Obama called his jobs summit to order just after lunch. That's right about when we sent our senior business correspondent Bob Moon off on his assignment for this Thursday, figuring out exactly how the president is going to kickstart the labor market.
The recession may be over, but the crisis of confidence lingers. And job placement expert John Challenger sees that as the key.
One way or another, we have to bring back both consumer confidence and business confidence, or hiring confidence. Employers have to trust that if they hire people, their business is not going to just turn south again sometime soon, and they're going to be stuck with people that they have to let go and all the trauma that that involves.
Easier said than done, of course, but there may be some escape from this circular fix. Joshua Shapiro is chief U.S. economist for MFR Incorporated. He suggests thinking small, because most American jobs are created by small businesses.
If they could do things that could free up some credit to small businesses who would then hire people and create jobs, I think that would be the sort of thing that you would get the most bang for your buck for, as opposed to, you know, something like cash for clunkers or what have you, which causes a two-month blip in activity and then you're back to where you started.
Another idea to spur hiring comes from John Sylvia, chief economist for Wells Fargo Securities.
Raising the minimum wage this summer was really a real mistake. The teenage unemployment rate really jumped. And it would be better to have a least temporary initial lower minimum wage for teenage workers or recently unemployed workers, but it's better to get paid $5 an hour than zero.
Almost all the ideas involve tough choices, but MFR's Josh Shapiro says if you're looking for some kind of magic, you could always try blinking your eyes I dream of genie style, which is another way of saying what economists have been telling us for months. It's going to take time to work our way out, and there still aren't any quick fixes. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
I dream of Genie and the economy, only right here. The big media deal that's been bubbling around for months now is official. Comcast, the cable giant, is going to buy a controlling chunk of NBC Universal from General Electric. Much has been written and much has been said about what this deal means for NBC and about what it means for Comcast. Not so much, though, about what it means for GE. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson has that story now from New York.
When I think of GE, I think of the lit-up red letters on the top of 30 Rockefeller Plaza, just a few blocks from our Manhattan office. But GE analyst Stephen Winokur at Sanford Bernstein says that image will no longer define the company.
the average American is going to think about GE as a power and transportation infrastructure equipment company, as they did if you go back long enough. It will no longer be 30 Rock, for better or for worse.
NBC Universal generated less than 10% of GE's annual revenue. The sale will net GE about $8 billion. Add that to other sell-offs, and the company expects to have a pretty sizable amount of money in its pocket next year. It'll need it first and foremost for GE Capital, its troubled lending division. But after that's dealt with, GE can start focusing on the core parts of its business. Morningstar analyst Daniel Holland.
It really helps them beef up and bolster their presence. They can go and acquire other companies, or they can just, you know, focus more on organic growth and doing more research and development, things like that.
The sooner the better, says Stephen Winokur. GE is hoping to take advantage of stimulus spending, not just here in the U.S., but in other countries as well.
Infrastructure spending globally. What's going on in China in terms of energy needs and transportation needs and healthcare needs?
Winokur says GE may sell off a few more parts of its business before it starts expanding. He expects the action to start in the middle of next year. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
The CEO search committee at Bank of America is breathing a huge sigh of relief today. B of A announced this morning it's finally able to pay back the $45 billion bailout it got from taxpayers last fall, so it will be able to pay whoever replaces Ken Lewis about as much as it wants. Seeing as how it wasn't all that long ago, though, that B of A was still on the ropes, we asked Marketplace's Steve Hand to explain the turnaround.
Bank of America was one of the largest recipients of TARP money. And Paul Miller at Friedman Billings Ramsey says paying back all of that cash in one fell swoop is a big positive, but
they still have to now focus on making money. This company hasn't made money in the last couple quarters on a core basis.
So if Bank of America is not making big profits, where did all this money to pay back the government come from?
Well, it's coming from, you know, basically not lending out any money. So as their loan portfolio has shrunk by $100 billion over the last year, instead of buying securities or making more loans, they put it into a cash account.
So if you paid off a B of A loan in the past year, chances are the bank just held on to that money. TARP was supposed to help healthy banks continue lending during the financial crisis. But some analysts, like Miller, now wonder if it had almost the opposite effect. Bank of America is using more than $26 billion from its cash hoard to cover TARP debts, and it will raise $23 billion more by selling stock and other assets. In the end, taxpayers lost nothing and even made a few billion in interest. So what's the government going to do with all this money now?
I think the best thing you can do right now is to give more money to state and local governments to avert layoffs and let them even hire some more people.
Congressman Barney Frank is chair of the House Financial Services Committee. He'd also back more infrastructure investments, and he'd like to see at least $2 billion be spent helping unemployed Americans make their mortgage payments. All these ideas would require new law, but Frank says it's about time to think about Main Street. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, all was well till right before the bell. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. This time next week, the news will be full of terms like atmospheric carbon dioxide levels and Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. The datelines will read Copenhagen, Denmark, because that's where the United Nations will be holding its big confab on global warming. Nobody really expects anything like a binding treaty to come out of the summit that starts on Monday, but that doesn't mean you can't market the idea of a deal. Sarah Gardner reports now from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk.
According to recent polls, only 35% of Americans consider global warming a very serious problem. And even those who do take it seriously don't do much about it or think they can't.
That's a branding problem.
Seth Farbman is worldwide managing director at the big ad agency Ogilvy & Mather. These guys have sold everything from grape nuts to Dove soap. Now they're taking a stab at climate change.
I'm a citizen of Copenhagen.
That's from a worldwide marketing campaign called, as you might guess, Copenhagen. It's an effort to drum up support for a global climate change treaty in Copenhagen. Major ad agencies and some of their clients are paying for it. Farbman says if you haven't heard it yet, you will.
It's on the radio. It's on the web. It's on Facebook. It's on Twitter.
The Hopenhagen.org website urges people to send emails to conference delegates to get them to sign a binding treaty. Farben says they wanted to get past the gloom and doom of most climate change messaging. You know, polar bears floating on melting ice floes, that sort of thing.
The brand idea is about hope, personal participation, and the core idea that people can lead.
Hopenhagen's also not bad for Farben's agency and other sponsors.
It makes them feel like and be perceived as good corporate citizens, good global citizens.
Adam Hanft runs his own marketing company. He says the obvious play off of Obama's grassroots hope campaign aims to create a groundswell of public support for a climate treaty. But some folks may not even get the Copenhagen-Hopenhagen thing, says Ed Maybach at George Mason University.
I think that name, Hopenhagen, is probably more or less lost on most Americans. If they're aware of the fact that we're negotiating an international treaty at all, my guess is they have no idea where that's happening.
Contrast that with Britain, where the upcoming talks are generating big headlines and the government is running its own ad campaign. It's called Act on CO2, as in carbon dioxide, the bad guy of global warming.
There was once a land where the weather was very, very strange.
That's from the campaign's TV ads. This one features a daddy reading his little girl a scary bedtime story about climate change.
Is there a happy ending?
It's up to us how the story ends. See what you can do. Search online for Act on CO2.
The British government got some complaints about that one, mostly from viewers who think global warming's a fairy tale anyway. Joan Ruddock is the Minister of State for Energy and Climate Change. She doesn't shy away from that gloom and doom messaging the Hopenhagen folks are trying to avoid.
People need to know this is serious and it could be very, very dangerous. So we shouldn't hide the message.
Adam Hanft says hopefully something useful will come out of Copenhagen so the conference doesn't ultimately get branded Dopenhagen. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Douglas Copeland hit the collective consciousness almost 20 years ago with his first novel, Generation X. Besides getting him credit for naming a whole generation, that book started Copeland on a career in which he has made a habit of writing about our relationship with technology. In a way, his newest novel, Generation A, comes full circle, taking us through a world in which bees are extinct and interpersonal communication is a dying art. Douglas Copeland, welcome to the program.
Pleasure. Thank you.
You have somehow commingled the death of bees. Bees are non-existent in this book, with the death of communication and conversation between people. What inspired that?
I remember the first time I heard about bees having the colony collapse disorder syndrome, and I just about wanted to vomit. It was such a frightening thing to even consider. And at the time when people began to notice that colonies were leaving home and never coming back, it was postulated that it was cell phones that were causing it, the cell phone towers and the waves. And I thought to myself, oh boy, you know, Doug, you're a human being, you know your species. If people had to choose between bees or cell phones, what would they choose? And everyone would probably say, like, oh, bees, of course, but then they'd be secretly off in the garage or the stairwell making cell phone calls. And that got me confused and worried about, you know, communication and what it does to us.
I wonder if you'd read a little bit of this book for us, since this is a book of characters telling stories. Go to the one by your character, Samantha Tolliver. I'm on page 203 here. It's called The Anti-Ghosts.
Her story goes that there was once a group of people whose souls had been warped and damaged and squeezed dry by the modern world. One day their souls rebelled altogether and fled the bodies that had contained them. And once a soul leaves a body, it's all over. There's no going back. The thing is, the bodies that had created the souls remained alive and continued their everyday activities, such as balancing checkbooks, repairing screen doors, and comparison shopping for white terry cotton socks at the mall. Well, their souls met in small groups at the intersections of roads, confirming with each other that what had happened was real, and it was, and that they hadn't all turned clueless at once. So, are we ghosts? Well, I don't think so, because the bodies we came from are still alive. Well, are we monsters then? No, because monsters can interact with the world, and all we can do is drift around and pass through walls and live a life of perpetual mourning. Well, then, are we the undead? No, we're not. But we sure aren't alive either.
I don't want to negatively impact your Amazon ratings too much, but this was a very not an uplifting book, I thought.
There is hope at the end of it.
Yeah, there is.
I'm not a pessimist. I'm not a Pollyanna. I'm kind of realistic about human behavior. I think that in the end, we're 50% plus one more to the good than we are to the bad. But I do worry about people a lot, actually.
Does technology, modern technology as we know it, help us with that? Or does it make us less able to deal with figuring out what people are?
I think we've just had to absorb too much too quickly. I've asked people who are much older than myself, I'm 47, you know, which seemed more startling at the time, the introduction of television or the introduction of the internet? And everyone goes, oh, slam dunk, the internet.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, I remember the 70s that all we really did in society is we went from rotary phones to push-button phones. And that was it for the decade. Yeah. And then the 80s came and we had music videos. Then the 90s and the internet. We have absorbed so much in the last, not even 5 years, 3 years. It's crazy. It's almost like we want a year out to absorb it all, but we can't. And it's probably going to get thicker and faster. And again, so that's where stories come in. It's a way of finding new ways of looking at ourselves and finding new ways of surviving psychically during all this change and turmoil.
Douglas Copeland, his new book is called Generation A. Thanks very much for your time.
Kai, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Coming up, asking for charity for the first time.
Well, in Minnesota, it's kind of tight for a man. A woman can always get help, you know, in pretty much any direction from most all agencies. With a man, he has to prove his point a little bit stronger and harder.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial shed 0.8% today, 86 points, closed at 10,366. The NASDAQ fell 0.5%, 11 points, 2,173. The S&P 500, well, I'm glad you asked. It unloaded 0.8%, 9 points, ended things at 1,099. Continuing worries about a weak economy pushed financials lower. J.P. Morgan Chase withdrew 1.25%. Morgan Stanley unloaded 1.33%. Goldman Sachs pulled back nearly 1.5%. But B of A, Bank of America, got a boost. It deposited 0.7% after, as we told you, saying it's going to pay back its TARP funds. Weak November sales sent retail stocks into a spiral. Shares in teen chain Aeropostale sunk 11.5%. Sank, I think, probably is the word. Macy's unloaded 3% today. JCPenney and Target both gave away more than 2.75%. Bonds fell a fraction. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.37%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term goals at Vanguard.com. By Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the curvy bottle, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com. And by Bank of America, which has begun a 10-year, $1.5 trillion investment in low- to moderate-income communities. Put our icon on your iPhone. The Marketplace app gives you the latest in business news, plus the Marketplace whiteboards and the Scratchpad blog. Just visit marketplace.org.
Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Friday. Unemployment was over 10% in October. The Labor Department lets us know if it got any better last month. The Commerce Department reports on factory orders for October. And the Consumer Federation of America wraps up its annual financial services conference. Issues addressed include the effectiveness of interventions to stem mortgage foreclosures and how the insurance industry should be regulated. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. When an economy slows down, like ours has, especially when it slows way down, like ours has, consumers start behaving differently. We don't spend as much. And when we do, we want to make sure we're getting our money's worth. That holds true whether it's a trip to the supermarket or deciding what charity we're going to support.
When I give, I get a sense of joy.
A sense of giving back.
I feel happy about making someone else happy.
It's just karma.
Today on our philanthropy series, Specificity, you can give to sponsor a child. You can buy a desk and chair set for a village school or a goat for a family. Donors get the satisfaction of knowing exactly where their money is going, and they can develop a special relationship with the person at the other end. Ashley Milne-Tite discovered, though, that those relationships sometimes aren't as special as they seem.
Listen to a snippet of this ad from charity Plan USA.
When we met him, 12-year-old Alex had just watched both of his parents die. The only family he has now is a very old grandmother.
Several years ago, my heart melted at a similar ad from another charity, Christian Children's Fund. I began sponsoring a little boy in India. I sent about $25 each month. It helped fund a program to support and educate local families, including his. I wrote him letters. He wrote me back. Then the charity abruptly informed me they'd expelled the child and his family from the program. They said his parents weren't sticking to the rules and were misusing funds.
We do everything possible to keep that relationship going to benefit the child.
That's Anne Lynham Goddard. She's president of Child Fund International, which recently changed its name from Christian Children's Fund. She couldn't speak to my case, but she says it's rare for the charity to end a relationship between sponsor and child, and if it does, it's for good reason.
You know, our good stewardship would say if the child is not benefiting appropriately, then we would need to inform the sponsor of that.
Okay, so my rational side gets it. But I felt betrayed and terrible for the kid. There seemed to be a disconnect between what the charity promoted, the joys of the sponsor-child relationship, and the reality of cutting the cord for business reasons. Tim Ogden edits Philanthropy Action, a website for donors. He says I got caught up in what he calls the donor illusion, the promise of a direct connection between a donor and an individual recipient.
And it's an illusion that's created by the marketing, and it's created because it's a powerful one for attracting donations. But the reality is, if you really care about doing the most good, then there shouldn't be that direct connection.
Because, he says, charities need the flexibility to respond to the situation on the ground. That could mean using a donor's money for flood relief instead of buying a family a goat, or simply not allowing money to be misused. He says many charities expand on their business model in the fine print.
The big problem with donor illusion is, of course, that plenty of people don't read the fine print. And when they find out the way things really work, they feel lied to or misled, and they react very negatively.
Something like that has happened recently at another organization, Kiva. The nonprofit helps donors fund entrepreneurs, mainly in developing countries, through local microfinance organizations. Until recently, plenty of Kiva donors, including me, thought they were sponsoring a specific person. The site posts entrepreneurs' photos and stories and encourages you to pick one. But it turns out that donations actually backfill loans that have already been made. Matt Flannery is co-founder and CEO of Kiva. He says Kiva changed the wording on its website soon after the controversy blew up.
We learned through this process that our users wanted to see more detail upfront about the underlying mechanics. Now, those processes were always described on the site, but I think we learned that they needed to be described more prominently.
He says donations are still flooding in. But why tout the personal connection at all? Because it pulls people in. Child sponsorship makes up the largest chunk of international giving in the US. Tim Ogden of Philanthropy Action believes it would be better if nonprofits drop the whole person-to-person idea.
The people who are being helped, the help they're getting is dependent on the whim of the donor, not on what they really need.
He says the more clear-eyed donors are, the better it is for the people who need their help. But that doesn't mean donors like me won't miss the illusion. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite. For Marketplace.
There is no illusion about the level of need this year. Even people who are used to giving are now having to ask for help. Sherman Wilburn is a newcomer to that side of charity. Mr. Wilburn, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I hear some kids in the background there. Is that right? Who do you have?
Yes, it is. That's my grandchildren.
How many of them?
Right now, I've got roughly about 8 in the house.
What, and just you? 8 kids and just you?
8 grandchildren. No, my son and Two of my daughters and daughter-in-law are here at the present time.
Now, I understand you've had to ask for some help in taking care of these grandkids this year. Is that right?
Oh, yeah. Thankfully, my son just recently went back to work, so that alleviates some of it. But in the meantime, trying to play catch-up with everything is kind of rough. Unfortunately, they won't see any Christmas this year until later. A little here, a little there, and things such as that and everything. But we'll be grateful for a family dinner and coming together.
You're able to put food on the table?
Yeah, some. Yeah, you know, it gets tight and rough and everything, but we learn how to stretch meals. We eat a lot of chicken.
Could I ask you, Mr. Wilburn, how you go about getting extra help you need from charities and other aid groups this time of year?
Well, in Minnesota, it's kind of tight for a man. A woman can always get help, you know, in pretty much any direction from most all agencies. With a man, he has to prove his point a little bit stronger and harder. Asking for help these days with the economy being what it is, most agencies are short on funds, and it's very tight and hard for him to get.
So how do you get things like school supplies for the kids and new clothes and all the rest of that?
Well, I have legal custody of my great-nephew, and this year I haven't been able to buy any clothes for him. He's wearing things from last year and basically hand-me-downs, and he is in desperate need. We're trying to find a way now to get him a winter coat.
In Minnesota?
Yes, yes, definitely in Minnesota, and you need one. Right now, this time of year, it's still cool enough to where you need some forms of a heavy coat on.
Now, I understand this is your first year sort of being on the receiving end of charity and aid, but you've been on the flip side. You've been giving and participating in relief groups for your whole life now.
Yes. I've donated where I could and when I could with time as well as financially and monetary. I was raised with the attitude that you do what you can to help someone else and step up to the plate. And I strongly believe that what I do will be, you know, returned to me someday, some way, somehow.
Sherman Wilburn in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Thanks so much for your time, sir.
You got it.
You can hear all of the stories in our philanthropy series, and you can suggest some of your own. You can head to our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Meritas, a worldwide alliance of law firms helping business owners and in-house counsel find pre-qualified local legal counsel for over 19 years. Meritas.org. And by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of a well-diversified college savings plan. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, a pair of matched observations about the state of Wall Street a year and some odd months after the peak of the financial crisis. Item one, the president today, at a question and answer session wrapping up his job summit, Mr. Obama was asked about new financial regulations. The president said he wants them done and through Congress by early next year, but then he also said it's important that those new rules don't, quote, overcorrect. Item two, Goldman Sachs. The Wall Street Journal reports today that the company is getting antsy about shareholder opposition to its plans for record compensation packages this year. It has gone so far as to meet with major investors to ask them, nicely, I suppose, not to object too loudly. And that is Marketplace this Thursday afternoon from American Public Media. Today, the Dow lost 86 points, 0.8%. The Nasdaq down 11 points, 0.5%. The S&P 500 gave back 9 points, 0.8%. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up tomorrow afternoon on this program, support groups for battle-worn HR departments.
So you've just had to tell 200 people that they no longer have jobs. You know, how are you doing? And, you know, every once in a while, there might even be a tear that's shed inside a small group.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.